Brandy I brought, if you don't mind. I said, Oh, absolutely, said Reiko. Could I have a sip? Sure, I said, laughing. Reiko brought out two glasses, and we toasted each other. Then she went into the kitchen to make cocoa. Can we talk about something a little more cheerful? Asked Naoko. I didn't have anything cheerful to talk about. I thought if only Stormtrooper were still around. That guy could inspire a string of stories. A few of those would have made everybody feel good. The best I could do was talk at length about the filthy habits of the guys in the dormitory. I felt sick just talking about something so gross. But Naoko and Reiko practically fell over laughing. It was all so new to them. Next, Reiko did imitations of mental patients. This was a lot of fun, too. Naoko started looking sleepy after 11 o'clock, so Reiko let down the sofa back and handed me a pillow, sheets, and blankets. If you feel like raping anybody in the middle of the night, don't get the wrong one, she said. The unwrinkled body in the left bed is Naoko's. Liar, mine's the right bed, said Naoko. Reiko added, By the way, I arranged for us to skip some of our afternoon schedule. Why don't the three of us have a little picnic? I know a really nice place close by. Good idea, I said. The women took turns brushing their teeth and withdrew to the bedroom. I poured myself some brandy and stretched out on the sofa bed, going over the day's events from morning to night. It felt like an awfully long day. The room continued to glow white in the moonlight. Aside from the occasional slight creak of a bed, hardly a sound came from the bedroom where Naoko and Reiko lay sleeping. Tiny diagrammatic shapes seemed to float in the darkness when I closed my eyes, and my ears sensed the lingering reverberation of Reiko's guitar. But neither of these lasted for long. Sleep came and carried me into a mass of warm mud. I dreamed of willows. Both sides of a mountain road were lined with willows. An incredible number of willows. A fairly stiff breeze was blowing, but the branches of the willow trees never swayed. Why should that be? I wondered. And then I saw that every branch of every tree had tiny birds clinging to it. Their weight kept the branches from stirring. I grabbed a stick and hit a nearby branch with it, hoping to chase away the birds and allow the branch to sway. But they would not leave. Instead of flying away, they turned into bird-shaped metal chunks that crashed to the ground. When I opened my eyes, I felt as if I were seeing the continuation of my dream. The moonlight filled the room with the same soft white glow. As if by reflex, I sat up in bed and started searching for the metal birds, which of course were not there. What I saw instead was Naoko at the foot of the bed, sitting still and alone, staring out through the window. She had drawn her knees up and was resting her chin on them, looking like a hungry orphan. I searched for the watch I had left by my pillow, but it was not in the place where I knew it should be. I guessed from the angle of the moonlight that the time must be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I felt a violent thirst, but I decided to keep still and continue watching Naoko. She was wearing the same blue nightdress I had seen her in earlier, and on one side her hair was held in place by the butterfly hair slide, revealing the beauty of her face in the moonlight. Strange, I thought. She had taken the slide off before going to bed. Naoko stayed frozen in place, like a small nocturnal animal that had been lured out by the moonlight. The direction of the glow exaggerated the silhouette of her lips. Seeming utterly fragile and vulnerable, the silhouette pulsed almost imperceptibly with the beating of her heart or the motions of her inner heart, as if she were whispering soundless words to the darkness. I swallowed in hopes of easing my thirst, but in the stillness of the night the sound I made was huge. As if this were a signal to her, Naoko stood and glided towards the head of the bed, gown rustling faintly. She knelt on the floor by my pillow, eyes fixed on mine. I stared back at her, but her eyes told me nothing. Strangely transparent, they seemed like windows to a world beyond. But however long I peered into their depths, there was nothing I could see. Our faces were no more than 10 inches apart, but she was light years away from me. I reached out and tried to touch her, but Naoko drew back, lips trembling faintly. A moment later, she brought her hands up and began slowly to undo the buttons of her gown. There were 7 in all. I felt as if it were the continuation of my dream as I watched her slim, lovely fingers opening the buttons one by one from top to bottom. 7 small white buttons. When she had unfastened them all, Naoko slipped the gown from her shoulders and threw it off completely, like an insect shedding its skin. She had been wearing nothing under the gown. All she had on was the butterfly hair slide. Naked now, and still kneeling by the bed, she looked at me. Bathed in the soft light of the moon, Naoko's body had the heartbreaking luster of newborn flesh. When she moved, and she did so almost imperceptibly, the play of light and shadow on her body shifted subtly. The swelling roundness of her breasts, her tiny nipples, the indentation of her navel, her hip bones and pubic hair all cast grainy shadows, the shapes of which kept changing like ripples spreading over the calm surface of a lake. What perfect flesh, I thought. When had Naoko come to possess such a perfect body? What had happened to the body I held in my arms that night last spring? A sense of imperfection had been what Naoko's body had given me that night, as I tenderly undressed her while she cried. Her breasts had seemed hard, the nipples oddly jutting, the hips strangely rigid. She was a beautiful girl, of course, her body marvelous and alluring. It aroused me that night and swept me along with a gigantic force. But still, as I held her and caressed her and kissed her naked flesh, I felt a strange and powerful awareness of the imbalance and awkwardness of the human body. Holding Naoko in my arms, I wanted to explain to her, "I am having sex with you now. I am inside you. But really, this is nothing. It doesn't matter. It is nothing but the joining of two bodies. All we are doing is telling each other things that can only be told by the rubbing together of two imperfect lumps of flesh. By doing this, we are sharing our imperfection." But of course, I could never have said such a thing with any hope of being understood. I just went on holding her tightly. And as I did so, I was able to feel inside her body some kind of stony foreign matter, something extra that I could never draw close to. And that sensation both filled my heart for Naoko and gave my erection a terrifying intensity. The body that Naoko revealed before me now, though, was nothing like the one I had held that night. This flesh had been through many changes to be reborn in utter perfection beneath the light of the moon. All signs of girlish plumpness had been stripped away since Kazuki's death to be replaced by the flesh of a mature woman. So perfect was Naoko's physical beauty now that it aroused nothing sexual in me. I could only stare, astounded, at the lovely curve from waist to hips, the rounded richness of the breasts, the gentle movement with each breath of the slim belly and the soft black pubic shadow beneath. She exposed her nakedness to me this way for perhaps 5 minutes, until at last she wrapped herself in her gown once more and buttoned it from top to bottom. As soon as the final button was in place, she rose and glided towards the bedroom, silently opened the door, and disappeared. I stayed rooted to the spot for a very long time until it occurred to me to leave the bed. I retrieved my watch from where it had fallen on the floor and turned it towards the light of the moon. It was 3:40. I went to the kitchen and drank a few glasses of water before stretching out in bed again. But sleep never came until the morning sunlight crept into every corner of the room, dissolving all traces of the moon's pale glow. I was somewhere on the edge of sleep when Reiko came and slapped me on the cheek, shouting, "Morning! Morning!" While Reiko straightened out my sofa bed, Naoko went to the kitchen and started making breakfast. She smiled at me and said, "Good morning." "Good morning," I replied. I stood by and watched her as she put on water to boil and sliced some bread, humming all the while. But I could sense nothing in her manner to suggest that she had revealed her naked body to me the night before. "Your eyes are red," she said to me as she poured the coffee. "Are you okay?" I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't get back to sleep. "I bet we were snoring," said Reiko. "Not at all," I said.
"That's good," said Naoko.
"He's just being polite," said Reiko, yawning. At first I thought that Naoko was embarrassed or acting innocent for Reiko. But her behavior remained unchanged when Reiko momentarily left the room, and her eyes had their usual transparent look. "How'd you sleep?" I asked Naoko.
"Like a log," she answered with ease.
She wore a simple hairpin without any kind of decoration. I didn't know what to make of this, and I continued to feel that way all through breakfast. Buttering my bread or peeling my egg, I kept glancing across the table at Naoko in search of a sign.
"Why do you keep looking at me like that?"
she asked with a smile.
"I think he's in love with somebody," said Reiko.
"Are you in love with somebody?"
Naoko asked me.
"Could be,"
I said, returning her smile. When the two women started joking around at my expense, I gave up trying to think about what had happened in the night and concentrated on my bread and coffee. After breakfast, Reiko and Naoko said they would be going to feed the birds in the aviary. I volunteered to go along. They changed into jeans and work shirts and white rubber boots. Set in a little park behind the tennis courts, the aviary had everything in it from chickens and pigeons to peacocks and parrots, and was surrounded by flower beds, shrubberies, and benches. Two men in their 40s, also apparently sanatorium patients, were raking up leaves that had fallen in the pathways. The women walked over to say good morning to the pair, and Reiko made them laugh with another of her jokes. Cosmos were blooming in the flower beds, and the shrubberies were extremely well manicured. Spotting Reiko, the birds started chattering and flying about inside the cage. The women entered the shed by the cage and came out with a bag of feed and a garden hose. Naoko screwed the hose to a tap and turned on the water. Taking care to prevent any birds from flying out, the two of them slipped into the cage, Naoko hosing down the dirt and Reiko scrubbing the floor of the cage with a deck brush. The spray sparkled in the glare of the morning sun. The peacocks flapped around the cage to avoid getting splashed. A turkey raised its head and glowered at me like a crotchety old man, while a parrot on the perch above screeched its displeasure and beat its wings. Reiko meowed at the parrot, which slunk over to the far corner, but soon was calling, "Thank you! Crazy! Shithead!"
"I wonder who taught him that kind of language," said Naoko with a sigh.
"Not me,"
said Reiko. I would never do such a thing. She started meowing again, and the parrot shut up. Laughing, Reiko explained. This guy once had a run-in with a cat. Now he's scared to death of them. When they had finished cleaning, the two set down their tools and went around filling each of the feeders. Splashing its way through puddles on the floor, the turkey darted to its feed box and plunged its head in, too obsessed with eating to be bothered by Naoko's smacks on its tail. "Do you do this every morning?" I asked Naoko.
"Every morning," she said. "They usually give this job to new women. It's so easy. Like to see the rabbits?"
"Sure," I said. The rabbit hutch was behind the aviary. Some 10 rabbits lay inside, asleep in the straw. Naoko swept up their droppings, put feet in their box, and picked up one of the babies, rubbing it against her cheek.
"Isn't it precious?" she gushed.
She let me hold it. The warm little ball of fur cringed in my arms, twitching its nose.
"Don't worry. He won't hurt you," she said to the rabbit, stroking its head with her finger and smiling at me. It was such a radiant smile, without a trace of shadow, that I couldn't help smiling myself.
And what about Naoko last night, I wondered. I knew for certain that it had been the real Naoko and not a dream. She had definitely taken her clothes off and shown her naked body to me. Reiko whistled a lovely rendition of Proud Mary as she stuffed a plastic bag with the debris they had gathered and tied the opening. I helped them carry the tools and feed bag to the shed.
"Morning is my favorite time of day," said Naoko. "It's like everything's starting out fresh and new. I begin to get sad around noontime, and I hate it when the sun goes down. I live with those same feelings day after day."
"And while you're living with those feelings, you youngsters get old just like me," said Reiko with a smile. "You're thinking about how it's morning now or night, and the next thing you know, you're old."
"But you like getting old," said Naoko.
"Not really," said Reiko.
"But I sure don't wish I was young again."
"Why not?" I asked.
"Because it's such a pain in the neck," she said.
Then she tossed her broom in and closed the door of the shed, whistling Proud Mary all the while.
Back at the flat, the women changed their boots for tennis shoes and said they were going to the farm. Reiko suggested I stay behind with a book or something because the work would be no fun to watch, and they would be doing it as part of a group.
"And while you're waiting, you can wash the pile of dirty underwear we left by the sink," she added.
"You're kidding," I said, taken aback.
"Of course I am," she laughed.
"You're so sweet. Isn't he, Naoko?"
"He really is,"
said Naoko, laughing with her.
"I'll work on my German," I said with a sigh.
"Yeah, do your homework like a good boy," said Reiko. "We'll be back before lunch."
The two of them went out tittering. I heard the footsteps and voices of a number of people walking by downstairs. I went into the bathroom and washed my face again, then borrowed a nail clipper and trimmed my nails. For a bathroom that was being shared by two women, its contents were incredibly simple. Aside from some neatly arranged bottles of cleansing cream and lip moisturizer and sunblock, there was almost nothing that could be called cosmetics. When I finished trimming my nails, I made myself some coffee and drank it at the kitchen table. German book open. Stripping down to a T-shirt in the sun-filled kitchen, I had set about memorizing all the forms in a grammar chart, when I was struck by an odd feeling. It seemed to me that the longest imaginable distance separated irregular German verb forms from this kitchen table. The two women came back from the farm at 11:30, took turns in the shower, and changed into fresh clothes. The three of us went to the dining hall for lunch, then walked to the front gate. This time the guardhouse had a man on duty.
He was sitting at his desk, enjoying a lunch that must have been brought to him from the dining hall. The transistor radio on the shelf was playing a sentimental old pop tune. He waved to us with a friendly, "Hi!" as we approached, and we helloed him back. Reiko explained to him that we were going to walk outside the grounds and return in 3 hours.
"Great," he said. "You're lucky with the weather. Just stay away from the valley road, though. It got washed out in that big rain. No problem anywhere else."
Reiko wrote her name and Naoko's in a register along with the date and time.
"Enjoy yourselves," said the guard, "and take care."
"Nice guy," I said.
"He's a little strange up here," said Reiko, touching her head. He had been right about the weather, though. The sky was a fresh-swept blue, with only a trace of white cloud clinging to the dome of heaven like a thin streak of test paint. We walked beside the low stone wall of Ami Hostel for a time, then moved away to climb a steep, narrow trail in single file. Reiko led the way, with Naoko in the middle and me bringing up the rear. Reiko climbed with the confident stride of one who knew every stretch of every mountain in the area. We concentrated on walking, with hardly a word among us. Naoko wore blue jeans and a white blouse and carried her jacket in one hand. I watched her long, straight hair swaying right and left where it met her shoulders. She would glance back at me now and then, smiling when our eyes met. The trail continued upwards so far that it was almost dizzying, but Reiko's pace never slackened. Naoko hurried to keep up with her, wiping the sweat from her face. Not having indulged in such outdoor activities for some time, I found myself running short of breath.
"Do you do this a lot?" I asked Naoko.
"Maybe once a week," she answered. "Having a tough time?"
"Kind of," I said.
"We're almost there," said Reiko. "This is about two-thirds of the way. Come on, you're a boy, aren't you?"
"Yeah, but I'm out of shape."
"Playing with girls all the time," muttered Naoko, as if to herself. I wanted to answer her, but I was too winded to speak. Every now and then, red birds with tufts on their heads would flit across our path, brilliant against the blue sky. The fields around us were filled with white and blue and yellow flowers, and bees buzzed everywhere. Moving ahead one step at a time, I thought of nothing but the scene passing before my eyes. The slope gave out after another 10 minutes, and we gained a level plateau. We rested there, wiping the sweat off, catching our breath, and drinking from our water bottles. Reiko found a leaf and used it to make a whistle. The trail entered a gentle downward slope amid tall, waving thickets of plume grass. We walked on for some 15 minutes before passing through a village. There were no signs of humanity here, and the dozen or so houses were all in varying states of decay. Waist-high grass grew among the houses, and dry, white gobs of pigeon droppings clung to holes in the walls. Only the pillars survived in the case of one collapsed building, while others looked ready to be lived in as soon as you opened the storm shutters. These dead, silent houses pressed against either side of the road as we slipped through. "People lived in this village until 7 or 8 years ago, Reiko informed me. "This was farmland around here, but they all cleared out. Life was just too hard. They'd be trapped when the snow piled up in the winter, and the soil isn't particularly fertile. They could make a better living in the city."
"What a waste," I said. "Some of the houses look perfectly usable.
Some hippies tried living here at one point, but they gave up. Couldn't take the winters."
A little beyond the village, we came to a big fenced area that seemed to be a pasture. Far away on the other side, I caught sight of a few horses grazing. We followed the fence line, and a big dog came running over to us, tail wagging. It stood up, leaning on Reiko, sniffing her face, then jumped playfully on Naoko. I whistled and it came over to me, licking my hand with its long tongue. Naoko patted the dog's head and explained that the animal belonged to the pasture.
"I'll bet he's close to 20," she said. "His teeth are so bad, he can't eat anything hard. He sleeps in front of the shop all day, and he comes running when he hears footsteps."
Reiko took a scrap of cheese from her rucksack. Catching its scent, the dog bounded over to her and chomped down on it.
"We won't be able to see this fellow much longer," said Reiko, patting the dog's head. "In the middle of October, they put the horses and cows in trucks and take them down to the barn. The only time they let them graze is the summer, when they open a little cafe kind of thing for the tourists."
"The tourists! Maybe 20 hikers in a day.
Hey, how about something to drink?"
"Good idea," I said. The dog led the way to the cafe, a small white house with a front porch and a faded sign in the shape of a coffee cup hanging from the eaves. He led us up the steps and stretched out on the porch, narrowing his eyes. When we took our places around a table on the porch, a girl with a ponytail and wearing a sweatshirt and white jeans came out and greeted Reiko and Naoko like old friends.
"This is a friend of Naoko's," said Reiko, introducing me.
"Hi," she said.
"Hi," I answered.
While the three women traded small talk, I stroked the neck of the dog under the table. It had the hard, stringy neck of an old dog. When I scratched the lumpy spots, the dog closed his eyes and sighed with pleasure.
"What's his name?"
I asked the girl.
"Pepe," she said.
"Hey, Pepe," I said to the dog, but he didn't budge.
"He's hard of hearing," said the girl. "You have to speak up or he can't hear."
"Pepe!" I shouted. The dog opened his eyes and snapped to attention with a bark.
"Never mind, Pepe," said the girl. "Sleep more and live longer."
Pepe flopped down again at my feet. Naoko and Reiko ordered cold glasses of milk, and I asked for a beer.
"Let's hear the radio," said Reiko.
The girl switched on an amplifier and tuned in to an FM station. Blood, Sweat, and Tears came on with Spinning Wheel. Reiko looked pleased.
"Now this is what we're here for. We don't have radios in our rooms, so if I don't come here once in a while, I don't have any idea what's playing out there."
"Do you sleep in this place?" I asked the girl.
"No way!" she laughed. "I'd die of loneliness if I spent the night here. The pastor guy drives me into town, and I come out again in the morning."
She pointed at a four-wheel drive truck parked in front of the nearby pasture office.
"You've got a holiday coming up soon, too, right?"
asked Reiko.
"Yeah. We'll be shutting up this place soon," said the girl.
Reiko offered her a cigarette and they smoked.
"I'll miss you," said Reiko.
"I'll be back in May, though," said the girl with a laugh. Cream came on the radio with White Room. After a commercial, it was Simon and Garfunkel's Scarborough Fair.
"I like that," said Reiko when it was over.
"I saw the film," I said.
"Who's in it?"
"Dustin Hoffman."
"I don't know him," she said, with a sad little shake of the head. "The world changes like mad, and I don't know what's happening."
She asked the girl for a guitar.
"Sure,"
said the girl, switching off the radio and bringing out an old guitar. The dog raised its head and sniffed the instrument.
"You can't eat this," Reiko said with mock sternness.
A grass-scented breeze swept over the porch. The mountains lay spread out before us, the ridge line sharp against the sky.
"It's like a scene from The Sound of Music," I said to Reiko as she tuned up.
"What's that?"
she asked.
She strummed the guitar in search of the opening chord of Scarborough Fair. This was apparently her first attempt at the song, but after a few false starts she could play it through without hesitating. She had it down pat the third time, and even started adding a few flourishes.
"Good ear," she said to me with a wink. "I can usually play just about anything if I hear it three times."
Softly humming the melody, she did a full rendition of Scarborough Fair. The three of us applauded, and Reiko responded with a decorous bow of the head.
"I used to get more applause for a Mozart concerto," she said.
"Her milk was on the house if she would play the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun," said the girl. Reiko gave her a thumbs up and launched into the song. Hers was not a full voice, and too much smoking had given it a husky edge. But it was lovely, with real presence. I almost felt as if the sun really was coming up again as I sat there listening and drinking beer and looking at the mountains. It was a soft, warm feeling. Reiko gave back the guitar and asked to hear the radio again. Then she suggested to Naoko and me that we take an hour and walk around the area.
"I want to listen to the radio some more and hang out with her. If you come back by 3, that should be okay."
"Is it all right for us to be alone together so long?"
"Well, actually, it's against the rules. But what the hell? I'm not a chaperone, after all. I could use a break. And you came all the way from Tokyo. I'm sure there's tons of stuff you want to talk about."
Reiko lit another cigarette as she spoke.
"Let's go," said Naoko, standing up.
I started after her. The dog woke up and followed us for a while, but it soon lost interest and went back to its place on the porch. We strolled down a level road that followed the pasture fence. Naoko would take my hand every now and then, or slip her arm under mine.
"This is kind of like the old days, isn't it?" she said.
"That wasn't the old days," I laughed. "It was spring of this year. If that was the old days, 10 years ago was ancient history."
"It feels like ancient history," said Naoko. "But anyway, sorry about last night. I don't know. I was a bundle of nerves. I really shouldn't have done that after you came here all the way from Tokyo."
"Never mind," I said. "Both of us have a lot of feelings we need to get out in the open. So if you want to take those feelings and smash somebody with them, smash me. Then we can understand each other better."
"So if you understand me better, what then?"
"You don't get it, do you?" I said. "It's not a question of what then. Some people get a kick out of reading railway timetables, and that's all they do all day. Some people make huge model boats out of matchsticks. So what's wrong if there happens to be one guy in the world who enjoys trying to understand you?"
"Kind of like a hobby?" she said, amused.
"Yeah, I guess you could call it a hobby. Most normal people would call it friendship or love or something. But if you want to call it a hobby, that's okay too."
"Tell me," said Naoko. "You liked Kazuki too, didn't you?"
"Of course," I said.
"How about Reiko?"
"I like her a lot," I said. "She's really nice."
"How come you always like people like that? People like us, I mean. We're all kind of weird and twisted and drowning. Me and Kizuki and Reiko. Why can't you like more normal people?"
"Because I don't see you like that," I said, after giving it some thought. "I don't see you or Kizuki or Reiko as twisted in any way. The guys I think of as twisted are out there running around."
"But we are twisted," said Naoko. "I can see that."
We walked on in silence. The road left the fence and came out to a circular grassy field ringed with trees like a pond.
"Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night so scared," said Naoko, pressing up against my arm. "I'm scared I'll never get better again. I'll always stay twisted like this and grow old and waste away here.
I get so chilled it's like I'm all frozen inside. It's horrible. So cold.
I put my arm around her and drew her close.
I feel like Kazuki is reaching out for me from the darkness, calling to me. Hey, Naoko, we can't stay apart. When I hear him saying that, I don't know what to do.
What do you do?
Well, don't take this the wrong way now.
Okay, I won't.
I ask Reiko to hold me. I wake her up and crawl into her bed and let her hold me tight. And I cry. And she strokes me until the ice melts and I'm warm again. Do you think it's sick?
No. I wish I could be the one to hold you, though, I said.
So hold me. Now. Right here.
We sat down on the dry grass of the meadow and put our arms around each other. The tall grass surrounded us, and we could see nothing but the sky and clouds above. I gently laid Naoko down and took her in my arms. She was soft and warm, and her hands reached out for me. We kissed with real feeling.
"Tell me something, Toru,"
Naoko whispered in my ear.
"What's that?"
I asked.
"Do you want to sleep with me?"
"Of course I do," I said.
"Can you wait?"
"Of course I can."
"Before we do it again, I want to get myself a little better. I want to make myself into a person more worthy of that hobby of yours. Will you wait for me to do that?"
"Of course I'll wait."
"Are you hard now?"
"You mean the soles of my feet?"
"Silly,"
Naoko tittered. "If you're asking whether I have an erection, of course I do."
"Will you do me a favor and stop saying, of course?"
"Okay, I'll stop."
"Is it difficult?"
"What?"
"To be all hard like that."
"Difficult?
I mean, are you suffering?"
"Well, it depends how you look at it."
"Want me to help you get rid of it?"
"With your hand?"
"Uh-huh." "To tell you the truth," said Naoko, "it's been sticking into me ever since we lay down. It hurts."
I pulled my hips away. "Better?"
"Thanks."
"You know," I said.
"What?"
"I wish you would do it."
"Okay,"
she said with a kind smile. Then she unzipped my trousers and took my stiff penis in her hand.
"It's warm," she said.
She started to move her hand, but I stopped her and unbuttoned her blouse, reaching around to undo her bra strap. I kissed her soft pink nipples. She closed her eyes and slowly started moving her fingers.
"Hey, you're pretty good at that," I said. "Be a good boy and shut up," said Naoko.
After I came, I held her in my arms and kissed her again. Naoko did up her bra and blouse, and I zipped up my flies.
"Will that make it easier for you to walk?"
she asked. "I owe it all to you."
"Well then, sir, if it suits you, shall we walk a little farther?"
"By all means." We cut across the meadow, through a stand of trees, and across another meadow. Naoko talked about her dead sister, explaining that although she had hardly said anything about this to anyone, she felt she ought to tell me.
"She was 6 years older than me, and our personalities were totally different. But still, we were very close. We never fought, not once, it's true. Of course, with such a big difference in our ages, there was nothing much for us to fight about. Her sister was one of those girls who are successful at everything.
A super student, a super athlete, popular, a leader, kind, straightforward,
The boys liked her. Her teachers loved her. Her walls were covered with certificates of merit. There's always one girl like that in any school. I'm not saying this because she's my sister, but she never let any of this spoil her, or make her the least bit stuck up or a show-off. It's just that, no matter what you gave her to do, she would naturally do it better than anyone else. So when I was little, I decided that I was going to be the sweet little girl.
Naoko twirled a frond of plume grass as she spoke.
I mean, you know, I grew up hearing everybody talking about how smart she was, and how good she was at games, and how popular she was. Of course I'm going to assume there's no way I could ever compete with her. My face, at least, was a little prettier than hers, so I guess my parents decided they'd bring me up cute. Right from the start, they put me in that kind of school. They dressed me in velvet dresses, and frilly blouses, and patent leather shoes, and gave me piano lessons and ballet lessons. This just made my sister even crazier about me. You know, I was her cute little sister. She'd give me these cute little presents, and take me everywhere with her, and help me with my homework. She even took me along on dates. She was the best big sister anyone could ask for. Nobody knew why she killed herself. The same as Kazuki. Exactly the same. She was 17, too. And she never gave the slightest hint she was going to commit suicide. She didn't leave a note either. Really, it was exactly the same, don't you think?
Sounds like it.
Everybody said she was too smart, or she read too many books. And she did read a lot. She had tons of books. I read a bunch of them after she died, and it was so sad. They had her comments in the margins and flowers pressed between the pages, and letters from boyfriends. And every time I came across something like that, I'd cry. I cried a lot.
Naoko fell silent for a few seconds, twirling the plume grass again.
She was the kind of person who took care of things by herself. She'd never ask anybody for advice or help. It wasn't a matter of pride, I think. She just did what seemed natural to her. My parents were used to this and thought she'd be okay if they left her alone. I would go to my sister for advice, and she was always ready to give it, but she never went to anyone else. She did what needed to be done on her own. She never got angry or moody. This is all true. I mean it. I'm not exaggerating. Most girls, when they have their period or something, will get grumpy and take it out on others, but she never even did that. Instead of getting into a bad mood, she would become very subdued. Maybe once in 2 or 3 months this would happen to her. She'd shut herself up in her room and stay in bed, avoid school, hardly eat a thing, turn the lights off and space out. She wouldn't be in a bad mood, though. When I came home from school, she'd call me into her room and sit me down next to her and ask me about my day. I'd tell her all the little things, like what kinds of games I played with my friends, or what the teacher said, or my exam results, stuff like that. She'd take in every detail and make comments and suggestions. But as soon as I left, to play with a friend, say, or go to a ballet lesson, she'd space out again. After 2 days, she'd snap out of it just like that and go to school. This kind of thing went on for, oh, I don't know, maybe 4 years. My parents were worried at first, and I think they went to a doctor for advice. But I mean, she'd be perfectly fine after 2 days. So they thought it would work itself out if they left her alone. She was such a bright, steady girl. After she died, though,
I heard my parents talking about a younger brother of my father's who had died long before. He had also been very bright, but he had stayed shut up in the house for 4 years, from the time he was 17 until he was 21. And then suddenly one day he left the house and jumped in front of a train. My father said, "Maybe it's in the blood from my side."
While Nako was speaking, her fingers unconsciously teased the tassel of the plume grass, scattering its fibers to the wind. When the shaft was bare, she wound it around her fingers.
"I was the one who found my sister dead," she went on. "In autumn, when I was in the first year, November, on a dark, rainy day. My sister was in the sixth form at the time. I came home from my piano lesson at 6:30, and my mother was making dinner. She told me to tell my sister it was ready. I went upstairs and knocked on her door and yelled, 'Dinner's ready!' But there was no answer. Her room was completely silent. I thought this was strange, so I knocked again, opened the door, and peeped inside. I thought she was probably sleeping. She wasn't in bed, though. She was standing by the window, staring outside, with her neck bent at a kind of angle like this, like she was thinking. The room was dark, the lights were out, and it was hard to see anything. 'What are you doing?' I said to her. 'Dinner is ready.' That's when I noticed that she looked taller than usual. What was going on, I wondered. It was so strange. Did she have high heels on? Was she standing on something? I moved closer and was just about to speak to her again when I saw it. There was a rope above her head. It came straight down from a beam in the ceiling. I mean, it was amazingly straight, like somebody had drawn a line in space with a ruler. My sister had a white blouse on. Yeah, a simple white blouse like this one, and a gray skirt. And her toes were pointing down like a ballerina's, except there was a space between the tip of her toes and the floor of maybe 7 or 8 inches. I took in every detail. Her face, too. I looked at her face. I couldn't help it. I thought, I've got to go right downstairs and tell my mother. I've got to scream. But my body ignored me. It moved on its own, separately from my conscious mind. It was trying to lower her from the rope while my mind was telling me to hurry downstairs. Of course, there was no way a little girl could have the strength to do such a thing. And so I just stood there, spacing out, for maybe 5 or 6 minutes, a total blank, like something inside me had died. I just stayed that way with my sister, in that cold, dark place until my mother came up to see what was going on.
Naoko shook her head.
For 3 days after that, I couldn't talk. I just lay in bed like a dead person, eyes wide open and staring into space. I didn't know what was happening. Naoko pressed against my arm. I told you in my letter, didn't I? I'm a far more flawed human being than you realize. My sickness is a lot worse than you think. It has far deeper roots. And that's why I want you to go on ahead of me if you can. Don't wait for me. Sleep with other girls if you want to. Don't let thoughts of me hold you back. Just do what you want to do. Otherwise, I might end up taking you with me. And that is the one thing I don't want to do. I don't want to interfere with your life. I don't want to interfere with anybody's life. Like I said before, I want you to come to see me every once in a while and always remember me. That's all I want.
It's not all I want, though, I said. You're wasting your life being involved with me.
I'm not wasting anything.
But I might never recover. Will you wait for me forever? Can you wait 10 years, 20 years?
You're letting yourself be scared by too many things, I said. The dark, bad dreams, the power of the dead. You have to forget them. I'm sure you'll get well if you do.
If I can, said Naoko, shaking her head.
If you can get out of this place, will you live with me? I asked. Then I can protect you from the dark and from bad dreams. Then you'd have me instead of Reiko to hold you when things got difficult.
Naoko pressed still more firmly against me.
That would be wonderful, she said.
We got back to the cafe a little before 3. Reiko was reading a book and listening to Brahms' second piano concerto on the radio. There was something wonderful about Brahms playing at the edge of a grassy meadow without a sign of anyone as far as the eye could see. Reiko was whistling along with the cello passage that begins the 3rd movement.
Backhaus and Bohm, she said. I wore this record out once a long time ago.
Literally, I wore the grooves out listening to every note.
I sucked the music right out of it.
Naoko and I ordered coffee.
Do a lot of talking?
Asked Reiko.
Tons, said Naoko. Tell me all about his, you know, later.
We didn't do any of that, said Naoko, reddening.
Really? Reiko asked me.
Nothing?
Nothing, I said.
Boring!
She said with a bored look on her face.
True,
I said, sipping my coffee.
The scene in the dining hall was the same as the day before. The mood, the voices, the faces. Only the menu had changed. The balding man in white, who yesterday had been talking about the secretion of gastric juices under weightless conditions, joined the 3 of us at our table and talked for a long time about the correlation of brain size to intelligence. As we ate our soybean burgers, we heard all about the volume of Bismarck's brain and Napoleon's. He pushed his plate aside and used a ballpoint pen and notepaper to draw sketches of brains. He would start to draw, declare, "No, that's not quite it," and begin a new one. This happened several times. When he had finished, he carefully put the remaining notepaper away in a pocket of his white jacket and slipped the pen into his breast pocket, in which he kept a total of 3 pens, along with pencils and a ruler. Having finished his meal, he repeated what he had told me the day before. "The winters here are really nice. Make sure you come back when it's winter," and left the dining hall. "Is he a doctor or a patient?" I asked Reiko.
"Which do you think?"
"I really can't tell. In either case, he doesn't seem all that normal."
"He's a doctor," said Naoko. "Dr. Miyata."
"Yeah," said Reiko. "But I bet he's the craziest one here."
"Mr. Armura, the gatekeeper, is pretty crazy too," answered Naoko.
"True,"
said Reiko, nodding as she stabbed her broccoli.
"He does these wild calisthenics every morning, screaming nonsense at the top of his lungs. And before you came, Naoko, there was a girl in the business office, Miss Kinoshita, who tried to kill herself. And last year they sacked a male nurse, Tokushima, who had a terrible drinking problem."
"Sounds like patients and staff should swap places," I said.
"Right on,"
said Reiko, waving her fork in the air.
"You're finally starting to see how things work here."
"I suppose so."
"What makes us most normal," said Reiko, "is knowing that we're not normal."
Back in the room, Naoko and I played cards, while Reiko practiced Bach on her guitar. What time are you leaving tomorrow? Reiko asked me, taking a break and lighting a cigarette.
Straight after breakfast, I said. The bus comes at 9. That way I can get back in time for tomorrow night's work.
Too bad. It'd be nice if you could stay longer.
If I stayed around too long, I might end up living here, I said, laughing.
Maybe so, Reiko said. Then to Naoko, she said, Oh, yeah. I've got to go get some grapes at Oka's. I totally forgot.
Want me to go with you? Asked Naoko.
How about letting me borrow your young Mr. Watanabe here?
Fine, said Naoko.
Good. Let's just the two of us go for another nighttime stroll, said Reiko, taking my hand. We were almost there yesterday. Let's go all the way tonight.
Fine, said Naoko, tittering. Do what you like.
The night air was cool. Reiko wore a pale blue cardigan over her shirt and walked with her hand shoved in her jeans pockets. Looking up at the sky, she sniffed the breeze like a dog.
Smells like rain, she said.
I tried sniffing too, but couldn't smell anything. True, there were lots of clouds in the sky obscuring the moon.
If you stay here long enough, you can pretty much tell the weather by the smell of the air, said Reiko.
We entered the wooded area where the staff houses stood. Reiko told me to wait a minute, walked over to the front door of one house and rang the bell. A woman came to the door, no doubt the lady of the house, and stood there chatting and chuckling with Reiko. Then she ducked inside and came back with a large plastic bag. Reiko thanked her and said good night before returning to the spot where I was waiting.
Look,
she said, opening the bag. It held a huge cluster of grapes.
Do you like grapes?
Love them.
She handed me the top bunch. It's okay to eat them. They're washed.
We walked along eating grapes and spitting the skins and seeds on the ground. They were fresh and delicious.
I give their son piano lessons once in a while, and they offer me different stuff. The wine we had was from them. I sometimes ask them to do a little shopping for me in town.
I'd like to hear the rest of the story you were telling me yesterday, I said.
Fine, said Reiko. But if we keep coming home late, Naoko might start getting suspicious.
I'm willing to risk it.
Okay, then. I want a roof, though. It's a little chilly tonight.
She turned left as we approached the tennis courts. We went down a narrow stairway and came out at a spot where several storehouses stood, like a block of houses. Reiko opened the door of the nearest one, stepped in, and turned on the lights.
Come in, she said. There's not much to see, though.
The storehouse contained neat rows of cross-country skis, boots, and poles, and on the floor were piled snow removal equipment and bags of rock salt.
I used to come here all the time for guitar practice, when I wanted to be alone. Nice and cozy, isn't it?
Reiko sat on the bags of rock salt and invited me to sit next to her. I did as I was told.
Not much ventilation here, but mind if I smoke?
Go ahead, I said.
This is one habit I can't seem to break, she said with a frown.
But she lit up with obvious enjoyment. Not many people enjoy tobacco as much as Reiko did. I ate my grapes, carefully peeling them one at a time and tossing the skins and seeds into a tin that served as a rubbish bin.
Now let's see. How far did we get last night?
Reiko asked. It was a dark and stormy night, and you were climbing the steep cliff to grab the bird's nest.
You're amazing the way you can joke around with such a straight face, said Reiko. Let's see. I think I had got to the point where I was giving piano lessons to the girl every Saturday morning. That's it. Assuming you can divide everybody in the world into two groups, those who are good at teaching things to people and those who are not, I pretty much belong to the first group, said Reiko. I never thought so when I was young, and I suppose I didn't want to think of myself that way. But once I reached a certain age and had attained a degree of self-knowledge, I realized it was true after all.
I'm good at teaching people things. Really good.
I bet you are.
I have a lot more patience for others than I have for myself.